I wanted to talk in three sections. First, just to say a little bit about myself to kind of situate it, because it is a personal interest, and I wanted to personalise it, perhaps just to sort of ground it somewhere. Then to talk about Barfield's ideas, and then to raise half a dozen or so implications, particularly in relation to psychotherapy, which in a way I sort of offer out that I hope will then lead to discussion and questions and clarifications and so on for the last half hour or so. So that's broadly the format. So please do store up your questions, and if there were clarifications in the meantime, as I'm sort of talking for the main presentation, then please do raise a hand and interject as well. So a small group, so we can do that. If you know there's a kind of what did you mean by that or something, it's best not to launch into a discussion of some parallel thinker. Wait for that to the end. But if there were clarifications, that'd be fine as well. Yeah, so just to begin with something of my story, my professional life began more or less as a clergyman in the Church of England. I was an Anglican priest, and I did a curacy, which is the first 3 years of after you've finished your training. It's kind of like an apprenticeship where you work with a vicar to get the ropes outside of college. And during that time, I see in retrospect, I had a sort of slow motion breakdown. At the time, I thought I was waking up and was breathing the fresh air of enlightenment and realizing that religion was a load of rot and Christianity was nothing but manipulative. And so I sort of left on a kind of high. But I can see now that it was much more complicated than that. It's not hard to get angry with the Church of England. It very much lends itself to that. So it's quite easy to do, actually. I found my way into psychotherapy partly because I needed to, but also because what it offered me was a way of engaging with reality in such a means that I'd never really had done before. Even though I'd been kind of religious throughout my childhood and teens, had gone to theological college, had been quite into spiritual practices, had been taken part in various communities that included things like silent prayer. But certainly my own particular course never really opened things up for me in the way that psychotherapy did. No doubt all sorts of reasons for that. But I think that, again, to sort of come to where I'm going to end up, psychotherapy has a kind of wisdom about the formation of our minds, and particularly our consciousnesses in the sense of how we perceive life, what we're kind of aware of, and particularly in relation to interiority. It's actually quite hard to find elsewhere, I think. And even in mainstream Christianity, which does have very many good sides in particular, as well as the bad sides. The concern for social justice would be an obvious one. The way that it helps to kind of contain people's emotional lives through ritual and that kind of thing as well. But in terms of personal growth and the expansion of our perception of life, particularly inner life, I think it does broadly struggle. And so that's partly why I want to offer my thoughts this morning. My own particular route was, first of all, I went seeking a new worldview, because I'd sort of kicked the Christian one to the side for the while. And so ended up doing a PhD on Plato. And thinking particularly about friendship in Plato. And the significance of that, I think, is that it was about how human relationships and how people's worldviews, sense of things, changes through friendships in the context of Platonic dialogues, and how the relationships are really key for that. Broadly speaking, because you get a sense of something different when you sort of smell it, as it were, in someone else's life, when you get a glimpse of it in their own perception of things. And I think that Socrates in particular became such a key figure because he channeled that to people like Plato and others. And that there's something about this living quality that's really important. It's not just about having a rational argument, not even about telling a good myth. There's something which you feel it in the encounter. And Plato, I think, was very alert to that, which is why he wrote dialogues, essentially. We know he only wrote dialogues for public consumption because he wanted to capture the living interaction, not in historical sense this is what happened, but in the sense that when you read the text you get a sense of it unfolding before you once more, You know, he's kind of like Shakespeare writing plays in that respect. But at the time when I was doing my PhD, Plato's dialogues were basically treated as the rather fanciful way that a smart guy liked dressing up his rational arguments. So in the philosophy department, the broad idea was that you kind of stripped away the extra material, the funny encounters, the preoccupation with where they might sit and talk, the myths, the poetry, all that extra stuff, and get to the kind of the nub of the argument, which is the good bit of rational meat. And so it left me, although I got the PhD, it left me feeling like I hadn't really got to grips with Plato at all through this, you know, otherwise quite high-level attempts to engage with him. And it was at that time, after I'd done the PhD, that someone said, you've got to read some Owen Barfield. Because Barfield points out that you can read people like Plato now and not have understood a single word that Plato was saying, even though you then go on to write theses and books about it. And the reason is because Plato's consciousness has slipped, as it were, below the horizon of modern consciousness. And so you gird it with the spectacles that you're wearing and see what you can see, but completely miss pretty much everything else. So that put me onto this idea that I've got to work on myself to recover some sense of what Plato might have been going on about, not just take my rational faculties, which I thought I had, and sort of apply them to these texts. And again, it was intimated to me that the natural inheritor, in fact, of ancient Greek philosophy, because of this business about how you can only know what you share with in a certain way rather than what you just analyse, the natural inheritor of ancient Greek philosophy is, in fact, psychotherapy, not analytical philosophy, as certainly you find it in Anglo-American philosophy departments for the most part. So it got me interested in psychotherapy. There were a couple of synchronicities as well. Like, I ended up living at number 18 Maresfield Gardens, which is bang next door to the Freud Museum. So Freud was kind of hanging around in the back garden. I remember reading Sally Vickers' book, Where Three Roads Meet, which has actually Tiresias walking through what was our back garden to go into the Freud Museum to encounter a dying Freud. It's a wonderful book. So it sort of felt pressing in on me. And also, you know, there's the personal story. Things weren't working out very, very well for me. So I, you know, needed the therapy and so on as well. And ended up coming here. And it was, you know, this sort of journey of my life, if you like. It was really hard. As I was cycling again this morning, I still get echoes of desperately trying to find a coffee shop to consume something before I got here, you know, some sort of comfort on the way. But it was very good too, and it has completely changed things for me, and personally, but also in terms of the capacity, I think, to begin to sense a different kind of worldview, and see life with what Plato called the mind's eye, as well as the empirical eyes, in the ways that, you know, become every day, in fact, when you become a psychotherapist. But every so often you do get some sense of how different that is, actually. And it's not just because we develop our own language and so it becomes a bit self-referential at times, but because, you know, we are, I think, encountering things that are there in everyday life but are not straightforward to otherwise engage with. Now, the Christian bit comes in is that I think that Christianity did actually hold this way of engaging with inner life for our culture for about 1,500 years from its emergence to the birth of the modern period. And now it's floundering. And I got, as it were, caught up in a tiny eddy of that floundering. But this general picture that Christianity is ceasing to offer the inside of the whole world, as Owen Barfield put it, to people anymore. And in fact, my sense now, I give quite a few talks, and if you mention Christianity, the instant reaction actually is to pull back. It's like it's going to restrict life, not open things up for you. Now, I don't know what's going to happen to Christianity, but I think there are things which we can learn from particularly medieval Christianity, and see how they are in parallel to psychotherapy and how that emerged, and that it can at least give psychotherapy this bigger context, this bigger picture, potentially at least. It's very much what Jung remarked one of his famous lectures on psychotherapists or the clergy, and he basically said that psychotherapy has arisen to fill a kind of vacuum that opened up, particularly in Western Europe, with the closing of the religious houses, which in this country actually were shut down in about 10 years. And I think this was actually a massive trauma in our culture that we still haven't really recovered from. When you think that in the 13th century, there were more religious houses in this country than there were towns and villages. They were the centre of our culture, in fact. And that had shifted somewhat by the late medieval period and the Reformation, but nonetheless, this storehouse of how to engage with the inner life of the world was just ripped away. No doubt it was full of corruption and all the rest of it as well. It's always a complicated picture, but I think that in some sense you could say that psychotherapy got going through the 19th century when people began to discover a way of trying to engage with the inner life once more through the sort of the interest in all sorts of things, from spiritualism to the beginnings of psychology in the 19th century and so on. And then Freud and Jung and others really got hold of. So that's something about how psychotherapy and Christianity might relate. So this is not to present a talk trying to convince you that Christianity is true after all. I'm still very ambivalent about that, but I think it's got certain things which are certainly worth engaging with. So that's some by way of sort of introduction. That's kind of like part one of this morning. I'd be very happy to tease out other thoughts on that, you know, my personal side of things, if it's helpful, because it can be helpful to illustrate things in that way. So let me now say something about this man, Owen Barfield. I've already said that he was one of the Inklings. He was born when Victoria was still on the throne, and he died when Tony Blair had become Prime Minister. So in some ways it's not surprising he got quite interested in how consciousness shifts, because it shifted pretty dramatically. My grandmother used to say that she thought the first half of the 20th century there was a lot more change then than there is now, because when she was born, there was no plastic, really no cars, there was things that people had heard of, radios, there was women's roles were still very, very heavily prescribed, and that changed in the first half of the 20th century, and then it just sort of got faster and cheaper in the second half. But she felt nothing really new had emerged in the second half, it just got faster and cheaper. But whatever you make of that, Barfield certainly lived through that. He went up to Oxford, which is where he met Lewis and the Inklings there, and he became very depressed, and in fact became very suicidal for a while, and it was recovering from that. Partly he fell in love with Maud, who became his wife. But he also just realised that there was a kind of inner world that he just hadn't really perceived before. And his awakening actually came through poetry. He discovered the Romantic poets in particular, and realised that figures like Wordsworth and Coleridge and others were talking about a reality that he hadn't just reckoned on at all. This actually happened to quite a lot of intellectuals in the 19th century. Another person it happened to was John Stuart Mill, the massive figure in British philosophy, and associated with utilitarianism, and he was a kind of childhood protege who could speak, you know, French and Latin by the age of 9, and was writing history papers and policy papers and so on soon after, and then, as he puts it in his autobiography, had a massive disturbance in his mental equilibrium at about the age of 18, and eventually, you know, essentially had a breakdown and became suicidal, but discovered Wordsworth particularly in the nick of time, and that opened up a whole other side of life, his emotional intelligence, you might say now, as well as his rational intelligence. So Barfield got onto this, and in particular what it made him realise is that words themselves in poems release a kind of energy, they release a soulfulness in life, and if you attend to that vitality, rather than, say, asking the question, what does this poem mean, or what's it all about, or what's it trying to describe, sort of reducing it back to the analytical mode, if you resist that enough, then this energy itself, you can follow it and it opens up new worlds for you. So that was his sort of first move, to realize that the poet, what they're trying to do is put words together in such a way that it releases this vitality, releases this sense of things that gives to you, that inspires you. But then he also realized that words could therefore be fossils of consciousness too, because what happens is that words change meaning over time. Like Lewis and Tolkien, he too was a great philologist. He was fascinated by language, and they were very learned about all sorts of old languages. And he realized that words change meaning over time. And they change meaning because they represent different mental worldviews at different points in time. So this is what I got onto with Plato. So say a word like theory, you know, kind of central word in modern philosophy. Now it means a sort of hypothesis that you test, a theory. But for Plato, theoria meant both a kind of contemplation, which means being open to what, as it were, the world, what you're contemplating might reveal to you as much as you going at it to test it. But it also carried connotations of journeying, in fact. And so theoria was as much a kind of pilgrimage to embark upon, maybe a literal or a metaphorical one. And the idea is at the end of it, your worldview had changed. So whether it meant going to the Delphic Oracle or embarking on a many-year training at Plato's Academy, theoria had this sort of sense of formation, or Bildung, as they say in German, that you have to change yourself. So words change meaning, like theory, and they therefore can be used as fossils of consciousness as well, that you can track how worldviews have changed over time. And I very much like Barfield for this, because there is evidence to his hypothesis through the study of words. He's not alone in thinking that consciousness has changed over the last 2,000 or 3,000 years very dramatically. Our perceptions of ourselves, others, nature, the cosmos, the gods, has changed very dramatically. Various figures have got onto this through the 19th and 20th century. But he offers a really good way of engaging with it, I think, because of his study of words. So he kind of operationalized this too. They were sort of academics and semi-academics, and they wrote learned papers about these things. But he operationalized it too, and I think you can kind of summarize it in this way, that, as he puts it in one of his essays, the problem that we face now is, how is it that the more we can manipulate the world to our advantage, the less we perceive any meaning in it? So this strange thing seems to have happened in the modern world, that we have become enormously sophisticated at manipulating the world and ourselves, often for the good. This is not to say this is a bad thing at all, or that it might be, but at the same time we seem to have lost increasingly a sense that the world projects meaning at us, and so modern alienation comes about. And it's quite possible in the 20th century to be a complete atheist, of course, not to believe there's anything more alive in the world than what's going on inside your own heads, and with luck, what's going on inside other people's heads. But the sense that there might be a transcendent reality, it's perfectly possible to live in a world where that is not even considered, or maybe rebutted, which is a very recent thing. And it's not really till the 19th century that became possible. The early scientists, for example, felt that they were recovering Eden in the 17th and 18th century. That was a powerful motivation for a lot of very religious early scientists. So they saw it as a divine vocation as much as anything else. But that has fallen away now more recently. And to cut to the chase, his solution is to realise once more that consciousness is not a tiny bit of the world stuck onto the rest of it, i.e. inside our skulls, but it is the inside of the whole world. Our consciousness is embedded in a wider consciousness, our intelligence is embedded in a wider intelligence, and that recovering a sense of that is really key to resolving what's sometimes called the meaning crisis nowadays. Now that's a big kind of big thing to set up, but I thought I'd sort of lay it on the table at the start. And let me give you some sense of how that might come about, and again, just like a snapshot at least. Here's an image of Van Gogh's The Wind in the Cypress Trees. And I think part of the reason why Van Gogh appeals so much is that he was able to capture, as it were, the inner vitality of landscapes. And in looking at them, particularly with their beauty, stir up an inner vitality in you as well. And so you get the sense that what you're looking at in a picture is actually drawing on what the artist was looking at in the landscape and seeing, and then communicating that inner vitality to you as well. So Van Gogh is a kind of poetic equivalent of the artist. But slightly more technically, I like this picture too, because it's about wind and spirit. And this was a key word that Barfield first kind of latched onto, that the Greek word pneuma, or the Hebrew word ruach for that matter, and I think I understand across a lot of other old languages, originally there was one word that describes now three things. So when you come across the Greek word pneuma now, you have to decide whether you're going to translate it as wind or breath or spirit. And so in the New Testament, for example, in John's Gospel, there's the English phrase, the wind blows where it wills, no one knows where it's coming from, where it's going, that's the way of the spirit. But in the Greek, it's the pneuma, no one knows where it's coming, where it's going from, that's the way of the pneuma, it's the same word. And Barfield, this is just one little bit of evidence for Barfield, that the pneuma was one phenomena in the ancient world that has now become split apart and separated into either wind or breath or spirit. And you have to, as a word, decide which phenomena you're engaging with now. But I think, to give the sort of Barfieldian interpretation of Van Gogh, you might say, part of Van Gogh's appeal is that he gives you a glimpse back to an older consciousness that feels more meaningful, more connected. And maybe you can even just feel that as you look at this picture, even on a slideshow, that it's about the wind. You can see that this is not a naturalistic representation, say, particularly in the clouds. It is trying to capture the spirit of what's going on. And maybe it just makes you slightly catch your breath. You know, if you can imagine walking into the gallery where this room, into the room where this picture was exhibited, it would command your attention. May slightly sort of take your breath away. It's stirring something up in you. Another way that Barfield reflected upon this was thinking about rainbows. And he was very fascinated by rainbows because they're sort of there and not there. That when a rainbow appears in the sky, we both see the same rainbow. And yet, if we both walked towards the rainbow, we wouldn't come to its end. We wouldn't find the crock of gold. Of course, modern physics now explains this by saying that the sunlight shines onto the raindrops, and that refracts the light, so it comes out in the colours of the rainbow that our eyes then pick up on. Barfield thinks about that process and realises that it's actually the inner world relating to the outer world and forming the overall picture. This is what our subjectivity, which we share with the objectivity of the rainbow through the light forming, that comes together to produce the image of the rainbow. And he uses this as a general idea, actually, that it's not just rainbows that this happens with. The way that we figure the world and the way that how we see it comes from our collective representations, our collective figurations. So, for example, the way that we see trees is very much shaped by, say, the science we've read on trees, as well as the walk that we had when we were young through the trees, perhaps when we think about worries about fossil fuels and trees that have died and created coal and so on now. You know, the way we see trees is very layered by the collective sense that we share about trees. If you ask a physicist what a tree is, they would tell you it's mostly nothing. It's just kind of quantum particles whizzing around each other. The botanist would tell you something different. It's one of a species that's, 100 million years old or something like that. So these figurations, the rainbow just stands out because it's a slightly strange object in the world that's kind of there and not there. But actually this is true for everything that's around us, and our figurations matter. So our worldview does change how we perceive reality. This is the sort of broad point, and so therefore that worldview can change. And I put two pictures of the rainbow up there because perhaps you can sort of see that the one on the left is the rainbow that appears to Noah in the biblical story. where the natural response for Noah is to offer a sacrifice to God, to Yahweh, in thanksgiving. So this is a rainbow that speaks of divine promise and the renewal of covenant and blessing and so on. That's the natural spontaneous thing to do when you see a rainbow. Whereas the picture on the right is an 18th century image by, I believe, an artist called David Cox. And for him there, it's the meteorological aspect of the rainbow that fascinates him, I think. You know, he's thought a lot about how to paint a rainbow against the, you know, background of rain clouds. And I think, you know, the kind of the fisherman with the river there and so on, embedded in nature. It's a romantic picture, you might say, rather than a spiritual picture. So that it also shows you how the meaning of the rainbow changes over time too. It gives at least an illustration of that. So I hope you're getting some sense of how the world of view that we bring to reality shifts what we see, but then also that changes over time. So Barfield's problem, as it were, that he sets himself is how can our worldviews change once more so that we can perceive depths in reality that we've slightly lost for all the gains of the modern scientific worldview that can explain, say, how a rainbow comes about. Now, if that gives you a sort of taste of what Barfield's on about, now to expand it a bit and set it against the Christian story, because he thought that in the West, the emergence of Christianity has profoundly shaped our worldview, and that we're still in reaction against that now. So telling something of that story can help to expand not just, as it were, the philosophy of worldviews and how things change. This is actually fairly standard post-Kantian philosophy now, that, as it were, your spectacles focus certain aspects of reality onto the back of your eyes and you don't see the rest of it that's out of focus. There's the backstory, the evolution of consciousness that's so important to him as well. And he begins the story, as is quite common again in telling the story of Christianity, actually about 1000 BC or more, 1500 years perhaps even before, with the story of the exile from Egypt. And he argues that the reason why this story of exile from Egypt became so powerful in the ancient Hebrew mythology is not just because maybe there were some Hebrew slaves that escaped at some point. That's actually quite likely, I understand, historically. Egyptians, who were a very powerful civilization for already thousands of years before this time, they would control small nation states by occasionally invading, extracting the elite from the culture, exporting them to Egypt, which was good for them because they got the benefit of the elite, and then left the small nation state slightly incapacitated so they couldn't rise up against Egypt. So it's quite likely there's some historical truth to the story of then some Israelites escaping from Egypt and going back to Israel. But he thought it really becomes such a seminal story because Egypt represents an older consciousness that the Hebrews began to sense they wanted to move on from, perhaps through their own sense of the divine and so on, the sort of nascent monotheism, you might say. And here's a couple of pictures that I hope give some sense of that. I mean, in my book, I really try to unpack this and give a much richer sense of it. But on the left there, you can see an individual making an offering before many gods. And the point there is that this is a pantheistic worldview. It's a pantheistic consciousness. And so there's not a unified sense of the world under the one God. And I think there's also not a unified sense of the individual. But rather, people experience themselves as kind of spirited fractions that through their devotions to the many gods that corresponded to their spirited fractions inside themselves, that's how they kind of held themselves together. That's how they knew how to navigate through, I think we're experiencing at the time, sort of floods of meaning, and rather than the struggle to find meaning. And so pantheism dominates, even in texts like Homer, which do touch on this older consciousness still. You can read about how, say, Achilles in Homer's Iliad will talk to his belly. As his belly is a centre of a certain kind of consciousness that he needs to negotiate when he is working out what to do. And then, of course, gods continuously appear in Homer and do things like pull back Achilles' head to stop him striking Agamemnon. So there's this sense of consciousness coming from the outside in, and that you knew who you were by the way you related to this external vitality that was broadly pantheistic. And it's immensely sophisticated. I mean, it's got its own kind of genius and its own wisdom. You know, you only need to go into the Egyptian galleries at the British Museum to realise this is an immensely sophisticated culture. It's not remotely primitive. Although I think it, the reason why people like Jung got onto it and called it primitive and had this numinous quality to them was because it was speaking to an older consciousness that's kind of in the back of our minds and maybe in our dreams or something like that. So it was very evocative for them. The picture on the right here is another quite famous moment in Egyptian mythology, which is from the Book of the Dead and the weighing of the heart. If you can just about make it out, that in the scales there's a heart on the one side where the dog god is leading the deceased by the hand, and then on the other side is Thoth, who's the recording god, writing things as it were down in the book of the living and the dead, with the monster that looks a bit like a kind of dog waiting to eat the heart if it's out of balance with the feather, which is in the other side of the scales. Now, this is sometimes interpreted as weighing the moral virtues of the individual's heart, when you can gloss it in that way. But I think that the minute you start getting into this and a bit of Egyptology, you realise actually it was something else that was being assessed, which is that the individual was being weighed in the balance in relation to their harmony with Mat. Mat is the kind of cosmic harmony in ancient Egyptian mythology, and a lot of religious practice and the wise pharaoh, as it were, they were judged not by whether they were virtuous in the sense of being individually good, as we might. They were judged as being just if their kingdom was in alignment with the divine harmony, with Mat. So again, it's a kind of outside-in sense of religiosity rather than an inside out, the individual being judged, rather their collective figures and their relationship to the whole is what really matters. So that's what's being judged here. The broad point is that this is a very different consciousness where the relationship from the outside in is what really matters. So what you get is the story of the Israelites escaping from Egypt. And here, if you can just about make it out, is a scene of the Egyptians being drowned in the Red Sea. It's a quite well-known image of this that's in the Sistine Chapel. And I thought of it because I knew I'd be talking to psychotherapists or people interested in that. And of course, when anything gets submerged in waters, it makes you wonder what's going on, going into the unconscious. Whereas the Israelites are on the dry land as well. You can even see they're kind of in the sunshine. They've kind of awoken to something in this image, not in the dark clouds of the old consciousness of the Egyptians back there, perhaps. I'm not saying that the artists thought of it in that way, but you know, maybe in this sort of collective symbolism sense, that's what he was getting. She, I believe it was man, what he was getting onto. So the stories of the Red Sea and so on, and entering into the wilderness and then the promised land, have this inner meaning. And I think you particularly see it in the stories of Moses. And because what happens is that in the middle part of the first millennium BC, around the time of the exiles for Israel, Moses as a figure gets very dramatically reassessed. In biblical scholarship, it's now known as the Deuteronomic Reform. And essentially, the idea, giving it a Barfieldian spin, is that people at this stage really start to work out what it means to become much more an individual relating to the divine from the inside out, rather than in the old dispensation, which was as a tribe or a culture relating to the divines. You know, Yahweh was one monk, one god amongst many until about the middle part of the first millennium BC. In the old ways, and they use Moses to do that. So for example, Moses is depicted as receiving the law from the divine. So this is not a religious practice based on going to the temple, paying respect to the ancestors in the ancestral grounds, the rituals associated with place, you know, like when Jacob sees the stairway going to heaven. It's a natural response for him to set up a column, a pillar, and to say, you know, God was in this place. So it becomes called Bethel. That's the older consciousness. In this new consciousness, the law itself becomes, I think even you can say it becomes a sort of spiritual practice that cultivates a perception inside yourself. So if you read the book of Deuteronomy now, which is the way that the reforms of this time have sort of, as it were, survived to us, it's full of what seem like a lot of very shocking injunctions. So for example, it says things like, if your father or your brother tell you what to do, stone them. And you think, you know, what on earth is that about? It seems to feed the old, you know, monster god in the sky that Richard Dawkins and so on will tell us is so abhorrent. But I think it's, if you read it as a sort of meditation, then it's an absolute cut across the older way of life, which was precisely to follow the way of the ancestors and your family and your kin. That's precisely what gave you an identity. And to say, no, you've got to struggle now, and something else has got to emerge. And we're entering a new dispensation now in the middle part of the first millennium BC. And the figure of Moses is used very much to kind of cultivate that. If you see the middle picture there at all, it's William Blake representation of Moses' horror that the people of Israel had built the golden calf whilst he was up the mountain on his own communing with the divine, and he smashed the tablets of the law in response. So this is the struggle. You might say, poor old Israelites, they thought they were doing a faithful thing building an idol. It's what their ancestors had done. It's quite clear that there were a lot of idols, for example, in Solomon's temple, and partly because the Bible's full of kings appearing again and smashing yet more idols, and you think, how many idols were there? But again, I think the sort of stories of Moses and the horror, the struggle, and Moses' own personal struggle, and he's constantly depicted as saying, I don't want this calling, I don't know how to do it, I can't speak properly, I don't know what I'm saying, etc. But Moses was remembered as having this vision, which is the last picture there, in front of the burning bush, where Yahweh spoke to him and famously said, you know, I am that I am. And I think that this sense that the oneness of God, the I amness of God, is, as it were, the most profound kind of ontological thread that gets picked up at this time. But it requires the cultivation of your own individuality in order to really perceive. You can only, as it were, know of God's oneness when you have enough of a gathered sense of your own oneness to kind of mirror or reflect that in. And so that's what this new kind of Judaism that begins to emerge from the first millennium BC gets onto. And Barfield summarizes it when he says, in the Jews, a whole nation was engaged in solving a moral problem and achieving a moral task, which have become the problem and the task facing every individual soul, which is why I think Judaism holds this very particular place in our culture to this day, sort of loved and loathed in equal measure. It represents both promise but also struggle, even now. Now Christianity gets onto this, of course the early Christians were Jews too, but Christianity gets onto this and launches it, giving it its own particular spin, that I think becomes the dominant mode because it's the one that is able to spread most broadly. Christianity gets onto Greek cosmopolitanism, for example, and the idea that everybody is a member of the city. Of the state, but also the city of God, which of course Judaism didn't have. It was always the elect as a particular people. When Christianity gets onto the key idea that it's the individual that counts, rather than, say, the family, tribe, citizen, state that counts, it can therefore form bonds from individual to individual, and so form new networks across the Roman Empire that have great benefit for people, such as caring for individuals who are otherwise strangers. And this starts to become very appealing for the obvious reason that people get looked after. But it's rested on this new sense of what it is to be an individual, because there had been, they felt, one person who had lived, Jesus, who was not only completely fully human, to the point of even dying, but that very individuality had made him utterly transparent to the divine as well. So Barfield's gloss on the kind of Christian statement is, in one man, the inwardness of the divine name, Yahweh, I Am, had been fully realized. the final participation. So this is the goal, final means the sort of teleological, the goal of what had been unfolding, participation meaning the sharing and experience of what it is to be yourself, relationship to nature, cosmos, the divine, the participation in life, you might say, whereby man's creator spreads from within, sorry, speaks from within man himself, had been accomplished. So this sense that God speaks from the interior of yourself rather than from the outside in, that had been accomplished. And, you know, the Christian phrase is the word had been made flesh. So this is all about having eyes to see and ears to hear, you might say, which is Jesus' most commonly used remark in the Gospels. And I love this picture by Piero della Francesca because it shows precisely that, that the new life, the new consciousness, the resurrection is seen by those who have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, unlike the poor Roman soldiers who are depicted as snoozing through, as it were, the pivotal turning point, the cosmic shift that Christianity felt had happened. So it's all about shift of consciousness, change of worldview. Now, how was this experienced in the medieval period, to give some sense of that? At its most highbrow, it was experienced with the mystical tradition that got going in Christianity. Here's Hildegard of Bingen's vision of how now the human mind can traverse the whole cosmos, can, as it were, reach across the heavens and participate in reality as God participates in reality. That is what Christian incarnation promises, that it's not just what happened in the life of Jesus, but that becomes a typology that's possible for all human individuals now. If their humanity reaches its fullest extent, it also becomes transparent to the divine. Excuse me. And so figures like Meister Eckhart can write, "My eye and God's eye is one eye and one sight and one knowledge and one love." Just to give a nod to other traditions, I think this does get picked up in other traditions as well. I think you can make the case that individuality shifts through the Indian subcontinent and even into China as well, and that new religious movements, new religious sensibilities arise because of that. So, for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna learns that only the material body is perishable, the embodied soul within is indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal. So Arjuna has that divine aspect within him as much as he has the material body as well, which will become perishable. He learns from Krishna. And I think even in developments in Taoism, so Xuanzi is a later Taoist, slightly later Taoist writer, and he writes as an individual, "And what I care about is the way, the Tao, which goes beyond skill, perception and understanding have come to a stop and spirit moves where it wants." So he, as an individual with the Taoist practices, is learning about how the Tao works in his perception and understanding, and sees how to go with the flow, to use the famous Taoist expression. And it becomes an inner calling rather than what it had been before, which was a kind of a perception of the external world. So it develops into the precursors of psychology, I think, when the Desert Fathers start to write a kind of a geography of inner life, which the most best known at the time was this chap Evagrius Ponticus. And he comes up with a whole bunch of what he calls difficult thoughts that you'll find when you start exploring this inner life, which, of course, map quite nicely onto the sorts of things that Melanie Klein has said. It's very fascinating. He said this in about the 4th century AD. It got rather forgotten, I think, but this is part of the rediscovery of psychotherapy in the 19th and 20th century. And for Evagrius Ponticus, these were things to learn to navigate. They became known as the deadly sins, which is a bit of a disaster, really, because that presents them as things to avoid. But Evagrius said, no, these are things which you'll just find, and that this is, as it were, the way forward to know how to navigate these things, these demons and these devils that you find within yourself. And that was very much the contemplative tradition at Christianity's sort of high point. Figures like Benedict, you know, when they found monasticism, incorporate this into the monastic way of life. It's a kind of formation that's supposed to help you overcome these experiences and so have a more direct experience of the divine. In more everyday life, to move slightly on to that, I think people would look, for example, at nature. Here's the pelican in her piety, feeding her young by plucking her breast. Very, very common medieval image. And the point about this is that they would look at nature and see not just what was going on in nature, but would see also how they might live by giving of their life to feed others, to help others. And they would also see something of divine life, that God was perceived as flowing his life into creation, which not only sustains it, but gives our vitality. And so as a way, your vitality is but an echo of divine vitality, which you would see in the world around you too, as in the pelican in her piety. Pilgrimage becomes a massive activity in the medieval period. It's, you know, very interestingly to my mind, undergoing a massive revival now. But here are pilgrims going to Canterbury, and partly because you could, because if you were basically a farmer, not a lot happened for about 3 months of the year during the winter. So life, you know, was shaped very differently because of your connection with nature, but also because it was a spiritual task and a spiritual undertaking, maybe to seek healing, as well as to seek the kind of transformation that an encounter with a pilgrimage centre might bring about. The saints themselves were ones that participated in nature and the divine most fully, and the stories and myths of the saints. Here's St. Cuthbert, a very important saint in this society, who was known for immersing himself in water in the seas. And sometimes this is told now as a kind of mortification of the flesh, but more recent scholarship is suggesting that actually that the point about these Celtic saints particularly going into the places like the rivers and the caves, preaching to the birds, and communing with the trees, what they were showing, the Celts that preceded them, the sort of pagans and the Druids that preceded them, was that God could be found everywhere. It was precisely a move from a more pagan, polytheistic notion of the divine, where you had to, as it were, make the right offering to the grove before you entered the grove in order to be protected from the grove spirit. The Celtic saints showed, know that the one God is known in all these places, and so that when they praised God, say whilst they were immersed in the river itself rose up and praised God too. So it was a new kind of consciousness, a new oneness, where your individuality could connect with divine individuality and through nature's vitality as well. I've got a couple of references if anyone's really interested in that I could give. If you go into a medieval church, you'll see these representations of the cosmos above the West End doors. Here's a famous one from Chartres Cathedral. And just broadly speaking, you know, they show the many layers of the cosmos that people experience themselves living in. So at the bottom there, if you can just about make it out, to people performing their everyday work. They're being spoken to by the angels who communicate the Christ above them. And then there's the signs of the zodiac around the arch as well. And I think that people experience life as kind of inflows of divine energy from the planets and the stars as much as from the saints and the angels, that you as an individuality in your work, your vocation, both reflected and navigated. And so, as it were, when you entered the cathedral, you were reminded of the world that the cathedral sort of amplified, you might say, or intensified for you, so you could know it in individual life. And it led to the cosmologies of the time. Here's a depiction of the intelligences of angels rising up to the divine, which was a very standard way of perceiving the world in which we live back then. And then people like Dante could tell stories of going on journeys through this cosmos, descending into the depths of hell, there on the left in Botticelli's image, in order to find out the darkest side of things, to, as it were, it's the kind of poetic equivalent of Evagrius Ponticus's inner journey and discovering the pride and the gluttony and the acedia and all the rest of it. And that's a precursor to then being able to rise through purgatory into the heavens, as is shown there in the image on the right, and Botticelli's image there of Dante and Beatrice now rising up into the highest heavens and being able to perceive that because their will, their desire, their knowledge, their sight had become one with the divine will, knowledge, desire and sight as well. which is very much the story that, that Dante tells in the Divine Comedy. So that's something about the kind of the highest flourishing of Christendom. So I'm now segueing into part three, if you're wondering just quite where we're going. It changes. Two particular moments that it really changes, with these two figures, particularly Martin Luther and John Calvin. In their different ways, what they basically say no, this whole system's got corrupt. Martin Luther's famous horror at what was going on in Rome, and then particularly over indulgences, and that we can't trust both the church and the cosmology that the church transmits. And in particular, Martin Luther says, you know, I spent years working myself free of this allegorical reading of nature, like the pelican in her piety, to return to the pure word of God in the scripture. And John Calvin says a similar thing. You know, he talks about the inner depravity, the total depravity of inner life. It just can't be trusted anymore. And they set up this kind of new struggle, you might say, which is how the individual can know that they're, putting it crudely, saved by God, but slightly more expansively, know that they're sharing in the divine life, that becomes Protestantism. And I think Protestantism sort of fragments in a way that Catholicism never does quite, and because of this new emphasis on the individual, has the downside of conflict, but the upside of a new intensified valuing of the individual that brings many of the great benefits of the modern world. Like, for example, there are more women in this room than there are men, because we value the individual as the site of education, not, as it were, the wisdom of the society as a whole, and that maybe only the priests and the professors attended to. So it sets up a new kind of struggle that's our struggle. The scientific revolution, I think, is another reflection of this. You know, it's not that the individual could, as it were, wander through the cosmos like Dante wandered through hell and the heavens in the Divine Comedy anymore. No, I think what happens with the scientific revolution is that the individual imagines themselves outside of the cosmos completely, that is a sort of precursor to the scientific study of things. What's objective now becomes the key test of truth, not what's subjective, as it had been before. If you wanted to know what was true, you wanted to get to its essence, its heart, its subjectivity. Now it's thought that it's the objectivity of things that counts, and so things like maths and so on can really get going. And Copernicus's heliocentrism there, which had been thought for centuries before. Heliocentrism was known in the ancient Greek world, but no one thought that it was the definitive description of the cosmos, because no one thought that you could step outside the cosmos. Of course, your immersive experience was always as important as any mathematical description. But that now becomes possible with the alienation and the disenchantment of the modern period. So, this is our predicament now, and then I want to sort of segue into part three and throw open some implications to this that I hope will then, in the last half hour or so, lead to some discussion and thoughts from you, because I've given you quite a sort of brain dump in the last hour. So one thing which I think I realise in psychotherapy is that psychotherapy is very much a way of trying to participate with the world once more. It clearly begins with your inner life. But rather than, say, more behavioural approaches, which are more scientific in the sense that they imagine themselves perhaps as interventions that, as it were, you can manage your behaviour, say, or to understand your triggers. What psychotherapy invites you to do, no, is to sort of participate with your neurosis, you might say. If it can be held and experienced safely enough, has the assumption that it's got something to show you. It's not just something to sort of resolve or put to one side. As the Buddhists put it now, actually, the obstacles are the way. So I think that one thing which I realised with psychotherapy that I hadn't realised when I'd had more behavioural attempts at psychology before to help me, is that it's learning to relate to issues rather than learning to manage issues, you might say. It can be a bit of both and, of course. I'm not sniffy about CBT. I think, you know, when you're in crisis, it can be useful as a first step. But I think psychotherapy invites you to take things a step further. And of course, when you learn to relate to issues, that also requires a reformation of yourself. It requires you to become someone different in order to relate to them. And so it becomes a reflexive process as well. And participation means that. It doesn't just mean, as it were, exposing your heart and mind to the kind of universal consciousness of the divine, like, say, you know, a psychedelic drug might give you an experience of. Psychotherapy is the much more subtle and harder work of yourself becoming different in order that you can participate with this wider vitality that wakens up to you every day, so you become a different person. That's something which I think psychotherapy can give us, a new sense of participation. So in a way, it's moving back to this older cosmological participation with this kind of modern spin or modern take in relation to our inner lives, through relating and forming ourselves in different ways over periods of time. Incidentally, you know, the periodicity of it very much interests me. So, for example, when Aristotle sits at the feet of Plato, which he did for 23 years before he started writing and setting up his own school, the Lyceum, and that puts into some perspective, you know, the maybe 3 or 4 years, which is kind of what I feel psychotherapy requires as a sort of good sort of start, you might say, rather than sort of 8 week that might get you sort of back on your feet a bit, but isn't the real participation and formation. You know, this is a lifelong undertaking, in effect. So that's one thing which I think is different, but helps maybe to revitalise, psychotherapy helps to revitalise. Another key thing, I think, is the use of the imagination. And Barfield and others, this is broadly true in the Romantic tradition from Wordsworth and Coleridge and others, they've realised that in the modern world, our imagination is a kind of key faculty for this new engagement. And what they broadly say is that the modern individual is a kind of like fantasy-generating creature. You know, we're constantly throwing up ideas and perceptions and worldviews and our sense of things. And again, in post-Kantian philosophy, this is not surprising, because Kant said, you know, we experience the phenomena, the way that things impact us through the patterns of our mind, but the noumena, the thing in itself, well, Kant thought remains permanently behind a kind of veil of phenomena. We'll never know the thing in itself, as he put it. The Romantics challenged that. That's why they're Romantics rather than straightforward Kantians. They said, no. The phenomenon must be transmitting something of the thing in itself, and there must be a way of experiencing that, particularly through maybe more ascetic routes into our experience, the experience itself, the felt sense of things, rather than, say, the more rational, articulated sense of things. So that's why poetry and imagery is so important, rather than just, as it were, writing treatises. But nonetheless, the imagination really counts. And what it does is it reaches out, you might say. It frequently makes mistakes. Fantasies are just, as it were, mere fantasies, and they kind of fall flat. You know, they either cause us neuroses or they just amuse us, but they don't really lead to an expansion of life. But every so often, what we imagine does really hit reality. And you know that when your sense of inner life expands and when reality expands for you too. So figures like Coleridge got onto this earlier on. Coleridge, one of his best known remarks is, the primary imagination I hold to be the living power and prime agent of all human perception. So that's just the Kantian point. So our imagination is the prime agent of human perception, how we experience the world. But he said it's a repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am. And what he's saying there is that when our imagination has this expansive quality, when it feels it's communicated something to us that's not just fancy but actually is true, he said it's true because it's sharing actually in the thing that made reality to start with, which is the divine imagination, that the creative act itself is a kind of outflowing from the divine imagination that we can share in, even just sort of get glimpses of or fragmentarily, by our own imagination that turns out to be true. This is how the Romantics reinterpreted the incarnation, that the logos, you might say, that became fully instantiated or known, transmitted through the person of Christ. It happens in us when our imaginative capacities connect us to the inner life of the world once more. Now that sounds quite abstract. So broadly the idea though is that it's sort of an inspiration returns, that it's expansive and it becomes an intuition, the mind's eye opens up to a new kind of ground of being. So you do actually experience yourself living in a completely different world. Let me just see if I can give you a momentarily glimpse of how this process works. What I'm going to do is, the next slide flashes up a bit of manuscript, a bit of music manuscript. It's from a massively famous bit of music that the minute I, as it were, give the reveal, you'll know what it is. But what I want you to do is, like, notice the moment of reveal. When this rather abstract manuscript, with its strange squiggles on staves on the page, suddenly becomes the music that you know. And broadly speaking, things like Barfield said, this is exactly what music does, is that it takes the abstract, the material, the physical, as it were, oscillations of the air, but they come at us, as it were, already preloaded with meaning. The imagination downloads from somewhere else the meaning of the music, you might say. So it's not just purely physical, but becomes meaningful. So see whether you get some sense of this. I'll flash up the slide. It's a bit of music, you know. Stare at it and wonder what it is. Let yourself have the struggle. And then I'll either say, or you might guess, what bit of music it is, as meaning, as it were, floods back in because your imagination reaches out. So here's the manuscript. Look at it for a minute. Maybe I'll give you a clue. If you can just about make out, there's these three short notes followed by one long note. Ba 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 ba. Yes, that's Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Wow! You hear Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, as it were, in full polyphony. Maybe that's to give some sort of sense of how it might work. Now, figures like, you know, Jung clearly got onto this. It's becoming more and more clear with the publication of the Red Book that he developed techniques of active imagination, where he seems he could sort of suspend the rational mind. Again, remember Barfield's comment about how to read poetry, not to go immediately for what's it about, how successful is it, you know, how does it relate to other poets, those kind of study of literature questions, but allow the energy itself to speak to you. And it seems that Jung developed the capacity to do this by following, as it were, the imagery itself. And then part of the practice was producing the Red Book, writing the Red Book. That became part of his own personal therapy. And again, you know, you may well already have a powerful sense of this, that when working with people or your own sense, to try and keep the energy in the room of the images or the problem and follow it as much as possible, rather than, as it were, making your interpretation too early, that sort of rather crashes what might be happening. It's part of the art of being a psychotherapist. And similarly with dreams, trying to, as it were, re-enter the dream can be very, very powerful, rather than saying, oh well, you know, you dreamt of fences falling apart because your defences are falling down, or something like that, you know, and sort of analysing it in that way. So this is to say, to re-stress the imagination. I think Winnicott was onto this. I think that Winnicott is quite a romantic figure, actually. And when he talked about fantasy not just being sublimations of inner anxieties, which is what Freud said, but being actually intimations of what he called the true self, opening up a kind of wellspring of life. He's very much in this romantic tradition. So it's a less reductive approach that's the case in a lot of post-Freudian psychotherapy. Adulation. So it requires sort of working on yourself. I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons why psychotherapy is so very, very key. But not just to solve your neuroses, you know, the clinical use of psychotherapy, you might say, but to realise that there are different cognitions which are available to us. So there's embodied cognition. And again, I think that in psychotherapy we use this consciously or not, just by saying to people, you're coming to the same place at the same time, sitting in the same chair or lying on the same couch each week. You're using the body to open up a kind of sense of things through the almost hypnotic pattern of that. it's almost like a pilgrimage, you know, each week. When I was in therapy, I realised that, you know, my trotting up the hill to my therapist at these odd times of day was a bit like the monk, you know, going to the chapel at odd times of day. And it was quite, that embodied practice, I think, was a key part of it, actually. It helped me to sink into a slightly different perception of things. I think time changes as a result too. You know, particularly you get a growing sense that what happened 30, 40, 50 years ago can be as active in you as what's going on now. So it kind of extends the experience of time. So your participation with time changes. And I think it's also, it's like a kind of initiation rite too. But part of the struggle of psychotherapy and maybe not wanting to go and hating the therapist and all that is that you're being invited into through an initiation rite, which, you know, as initiation rites always say, the key bit of change is actually the struggle. That's what you've got to go through. You've got to go through Moses, like going through the wilderness. The youngster in indigenous cultures going through the trial in order to be reborn and so on. I think psychotherapy can really bring these old ideas back to the modern world as a result. So psychotherapy is a spiritual practice, you might say, as much as a clinical undertaking. Object relations, which was the backbone of the kind of theoretical training here, I think there's a lot more that we can do with object relations, useful as they are, and people are doing this. This isn't just my idea. Here's some images of Blake that I hope bring this to life. One thing is object relations do, like the image of the nightmare on the left, or it's actually an image of Hecate, but it's often interpreted as a kind of nightmarish theme. It makes you realise that there are, as it were, spirited factions alive inside you that you're learning to relate to, maybe in some almost like polytheistic sense, and that personalities, part personalities, different complexes, to use the Jungian phrase, are alive inside you. And I've been involved in a group therapy known as family constellations as well. That's one of the things which really awoke me to this possibility. And what happens in family constellations, I think, is that in a circle, the person with what's called the issue in that sense, the person who's presenting something that's troubling them, they basically pick individuals in the circle to represent different aspects of their inner life. And then you move these people around in the constellations in different shapes to see, you know, what feels better, what feels worse, what feels like it's got somewhere to go, what feels stuck and so on. It's a kind of externalization, I think, of the inner objects, to use that model. And so you then ask, you know, if these things are not just inside you, but they can be externalized, maybe they're playing out in your family system, in your workplace and so on. Are they, it raises the question, you know, are they actually alive in nature? Are they cosmic truths as well? They're not just, as it were, objects stuck onto the rest of the world, like your consciousness is stuck onto the rest of the world, but maybe some sort of reflection of the inner life of all things. And I think Blake certainly experienced this. So here's Blake's image of the sun rising. And as has been said, you know, when Blake saw the sunrise, he didn't just read more into the sun, he saw more of the sun. That he, as it were, was able to have these eyes that perceive the inner vitality of all things. I think this happens a lot in our erotic relations. I share a room or rent a room from a Jungian analyst called Giorgio Giocardi, and Giorgio has written a lot about sexuality, particularly following on from the idea that our sexuality is born of a sort of developmental crisis, which was the old sort of Freudian, post-Freudian way of doing it, that sort of failed. Our sexuality is not a product of our Oedipal situation and all that. And what he's wondering, using more Jungian ideas, is that maybe our sexuality is a result of identifications with different archetypes, and that sexuality, therefore, can be much more fluid. Now, there's a lot more that can be said about this, as it were, but the point about it is that maybe our desires and longings and how we project them onto other people are part of our sharing in the kind of collective consciousness, the inside of the whole world, that for various reasons, which may or may not become transparent, we identify with at different times. And I like this because Eros has always been seen as the kind of key spiritual energy. You know, when Dante embarks on his journey, it's because of erotic desire awoken in him with glimpsing Beatrice. I wonder whether there's a whole new kind of erotic psychology that can be rewritten, thinking about things in this way. And again, it's about not just, as it were, acting on the erotic impulse, but trying to stay with the energy and see where it relates to you. It goes all the way back to Plato. You know, Plato's Ascent in the Symposium. He says, you know, first of all, you fall in love with one beautiful person, and then you realise there's a lot of beauty in the world, and it sort of takes you on an ascent up to divine beauty, ultimately. So a few rambling thoughts. I want to give time for questions. Going on longer than I thought. This is just to sort of say follow the energy. Another Blakean image which I really like. It's like a soul being led by the inner life, depicted almost as an angel. So I've stressed this quite a lot now, actually, the idea of following the energy rather than interpreting too quickly. And maybe just to sort of finally, a final comment to sort of bring this down to something a bit more tangible. This idea that we're perhaps reawakening to spiritual vitality, even spiritual beings that are in the world, and not just, as it were, in our heads and projections onto the world. I'm really fascinated about how we can really flesh this out so it just doesn't just become some sort of esoteric interest of the new age, or that maybe, you know, you can see people engaging with when they go to angel summits or something like this. You know, is this actually something much more pervasive that we can engage with, so that our inner life can reflect the inner life of all things, that solution that Barfield proposed at the beginning? And I was very struck by the TV adaptation of Philip Pullman's great books. But what's so fascinating, I think, about Philip Pullman's depiction of this world is that he knows there's other vitalities around and about, which he, you know, most brilliantly depicts with the individual and their demon, his Lyra and Pantalaimon, in the stories. But this is a spoiler alert. The books ultimately fail, I think, because when the divine is ultimately encountered at the end of the books, the divine just disappears into dust, and sort of smiles and, as it were, gives up the ghost. And I think that Philip's books are as much about the crisis of our time, struggling to reawaken to spiritual beings, you might say, our souls, the soulfulness of all things, as anything else. But they're key indicators. He, of course, is very, very influenced by William Blake. He's the chair of the William Blake Society. I think Blake was onto this all the more. Here's his depiction of your reason, and he saw as a kind of god that's alive in the modern world. And he depicted it like this because, and the point about reason, when it's left on its own and isn't filled out particularly by the imagination, is that it doesn't know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. The eyes are actually blank, even though it feels it's writing about something. I think that they're probably stone tablets depicting the law behind it in a rather reductive sense, just sort of following, as it were, the logic of things rather than really participating with things. So I like Blake. Go to the Blake exhibition at Tate Britain if you haven't, and you get overwhelmed by Blake's inner life. But if you can tolerate the energy, as it were, then it really is wonderful little initiation rite to try and tap into what he might have been seeing, I think. Sci-fi does it. I think this is one of the reasons why sci-fi is so popular. I think we're haunted by AIs at the moment. And because we are getting the sense that there are intelligences more powerful than us around and about, but because we can't relate to them directly, because we've broadly lost the spiritual sense, certainly in our wider culture, they get projected onto the future controlled by monstrous AIs, as it were, they're demons rather than deities. And so I'm very fascinated myself by all the discussion around AIs. I've no doubt that computers will become smarter and smarter, but what is so interesting is that they're often talked about either as a kind of future utopia or as a future apocalypse. And, you know, the psychotherapist, of course, immediately wonders what that's about. My favourite sci-fi film, I thought, did something really, really interesting and good with it. And if you want to watch a film this evening, I think you can download it off Netflix, is the film Arrival. And I thought this was so brilliant because it's a first contact movie. You know, the aliens arrive, but the key hero, what she has to do is shift her consciousness in order to understand what the aliens are talking about. I don't want to spoil it too much, but I think it's this brilliant film because it takes her on a new way of participating with the inner life of the aliens, and it actually turns out to be the inner life of the cosmos as well. And so, you know, the promise is, as Doré depicts it here with his Dante and Beatrice envisaging the heavens as a whole, is a new sense of the inner life of all things. And I wonder whether, you know, psychotherapy's vision can be, you know, no less, as it were, expansive than that. Moving on from the clinical focus, which is often the case, rightly, because you get a job out of it, but also because it is the personal work that has got to be done in order to not spiritually bypass the personal issues, but to really feel these things are grounded. There's a little summary of some of the implications, perhaps. Participation in and relating to these incarnational moments as we're experiencing them, and imagination revealing in a life like with music. Psychotherapy is a spiritual practice that initiates embodied cognitions, embodied sense of time. There's these synchronicities as well. I wonder about art object relations, a way of thinking about relating to spiritual beings once more. You know, Jung famously remarked that the gods have become diseases. Can the diseases become the gods once more, perhaps? Following the energy and the spirit of things, and then maybe revealing kind of new intelligences, new sense of the inner life of all things, as Barfield put it. I'll leave that up perhaps as a prompt. I have gone on for longer than I anticipated. I didn't realise I could talk so much on Saturday morning when I woke up, but nonetheless I could. But we have got 10 minutes at least, perhaps to pick up on some threads, some comments. There is a book too. I hope maybe we're going to go away, I hope feeling provoked at least, to pick up on some of these things. We are a small group, so if you did want to email me at a later stage, then please do as well. I'd be happy to talk about it more. But any initial thoughts or comments, at least, even if just clarifications?
So I've always thought that psychotherapy is a spiritual practice, but it's very difficult to explain what that means. And in a way, we're sort of talking in that way all the time. And you reminded me of years ago, I did an English degree, and the question on the medieval mystics was always, how did the medieval mystics express the inexpressible? And it's like, I was thinking, it's very difficult to express. But there's also this problem of not wanting to appear too Christian, because of the, we don't like God in the box, who want, and what does it all mean, isn't it? And I enjoyed listening to you. I've already bought your book, actually. I haven't read it yet. yes, you're trying to expand the things that I think about, and it'd be interesting to read about Barfield and precisely what he said, etc.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
I mean, I think that the sense of the spiritual ecology of the world is actually closer to us than we think. That certainly, say Christianity, the idea that it's about relating to God through Jesus and that's about it, it's actually quite a recent twist. I've actually read historians that have made the case that it really only happened in the 19th century, when the issue about becoming an atheist came to the fore, and so it got focused on, do you believe in God or not? But for most of human history, yeah, and are you saved and so on, most of human history wasn't like that. You know, it was about pilgrimage, it was about different devotions and so on. You still pick this up in more Catholic countries. I was in Malta just after Easter, and staying with some a friend who's married into a Maltese family, and they kept talking about how it rains on Mary's Day, because we of course were saying, what's the weather going to be like today, is it going to be sunny? And they kept saying, it only rains on Mary's Day. And I was like, what? And it's, you know, it was like they still think of the year, the seasons, through the saints. So it was like a nice little glimpse to this older kind of spiritual world.
I think it's in, I mean, I like the idea of psychotherapy as a spiritual practice, and the way that you presented it as sort of the true successor of philosophy. But I guess what I was thinking about is how that, I don't, there's not an answer to this, this is just a comment, how there is such a tension between psychotherapy as a spiritual practice and evidence-based practice and research and kind of that side of things that's happening in our profession. It feels really contradictory, you know.
Yeah. So this isn't an answer, but it is a thought in response. But I've been greatly heartened recently by, I think it's a new strand in the sense of what it means to have evolved as Homo sapiens. And that it's not the dominant story, which is represented in books like, say, Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, which is basically technologically driven, which has that material quality and the evidence. Empirical demand fits into all that, but realizes that in order, for example, to make a hand axe that isn't just functional but is beautiful, that exceeds its function, it would have taken our ancestors perhaps centuries of just being, as it were, engaged with material reality and with the energy, you might say, of stone, in order to sort of develop the technology in order to be able to produce it. And these, you know, you can't just think, oh, I'm going to make a beautiful hand axe rather than a functional hand axe one day. Your whole mind has to grow and open up. And so there is a new strand talking about human evolution now that is realizing that the spiritual side actually was in the driving seat, and that the technology and the more material side is the byproduct, you know, of Homo spiritualis, or, you know, however it might be put in a book title. Now, that doesn't, you know, answer your question in terms of our profession now, but I wonder whether there is a bit of a sea change coming about where people are realising that inner life contemplation, what you might call the spiritual dimension, for want of a better word, I know it's not a very good word, but this is actually more important than has been thought for quite some time. I certainly hope so.
Why don't we call that prayer? Because prayer is about the relationship that you began by talking about as being an absolute, you know, a prerequisite almost, and rather than this more abstract idea of imagination as experience, and, you know, prayer, it could be called prayer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it could be, but it, part of the struggle, and it, you know, the struggle is really part of it. It's not just. I wish we didn't have to struggle. You do have to struggle. Mm. Is that words are freighted, mm. and prayer is freighted.
Yeah.
You know, and even if you're into prayer, you might spend quite a long time, many years, working at what prayer really is.
I'm sure you know. Well,
yeah.
Do.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Factor,
yeah.
When you try, you do. You spend. That is where the energy is.
Yeah.
In the struggle, in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
if I was in a church, I would say prayer, because I would know that would sort of land in the right way. Yeah.
Not a very well thought out thought, but something about the analytic third of the world, and that sense of the other coming into the room, the third, I suppose, the reverie, and I suppose that can be thought of as either the unconscious or something other, and where does the unconscious and God or spiritual being, and that area is very interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and again, with engaging with this kind of romantic thought, I've related it very much to the idea of polarities in romantic philosophy, where essentially this is in Blake and it's in Coleridge. The idea is that you hold two poles that are apparently incommensurate, and but wrestle with the tension in order that a third can appear from the energy that produces. Yeah, so I think that the analytic third can be fed into that. I mean, it's broader what Jung was saying with the transcendent function, I think. My sense is, I don't know whether you can actually make the case, but I wonder whether a lot of post-Freudian reinterpretations of the Oedipal third, so rather than seeing it developmentally, start to see it as psychodynamically, and in people like Thomas Ogden and so on, yeah. So I think the third is a key idea, yeah. But we need to slightly move away from that slightly literal sort of Freudian interpretation of it.
The sense of the spirit, all the energy. I mean, it could be the kind of experience, lovely.
Yeah.
Very much that, that dreams, basically, you're saying before the cutting by interpretation, and staying with that.
Yeah. Maybe one last thought or comment, just to at least have other things aired, if there were anything else someone wanted to flag up. Yeah.
What happened in 1543, was it?
Oh,
those two pictures.
Yes, that was when Copernicus's On the Revolution of Spheres was published. Yeah, sorry, I should have said that. I didn't spell that out, yeah. So it's, you know, it's a sort of one date to hang these things on. Copernicus actually did devote his book, he dedicated his book to the Pope, and everyone read it and thought, oh, that's very interesting, but nothing much happened for quite a while. It wasn't until Galileo came along, who was a much more antagonistic figure, and wrote dialogues calling the Pope Simplicitus or something like that, that it started to cause waves. Yeah.
Was Galileo excommunicated
for heresy? I think he did recant, but then he was placed under house arrest.
Maybe something happened to him.
Yeah, no. It's not an admirable moment in the church's history, for sure. But it's more
on
because
on a scale of 1 to 10, there might be some other things going on there.
Yeah.
That we might not be so.
Yeah. But no, I think because there's the famous remark that in the Brecht play on Galileo, isn't it, where he says it, but it moves or something. He said because the Earth does move around the Sun.
Yeah.
I mean, interesting. Barfield said that the significance about the modern scientific revolution isn't just this objective sense, but it is this claim that what the science is describing is real and true. That before, the idea was you have many different models that saves the appearances, as it was called, and you needed lots of different models to navigate reality. That was the kind of assumption, rather than this kind of the claim of modern science that, in principle at least, there's one theory of everything that the evidence, you know, will show is right. And I didn't think of this earlier, but maybe that's another thing that you learn in psychotherapy, is that, you know, you need to learn about a bit of Winnicott, a bit of Klein, a bit of this, because then you've got a whole toolbox to bring to the situation that enables you to take the next step rather than resolve it all. Yeah.
But I think that's one of the challenges of the whole research drive around psychoanalytic or psychodynamic therapy, isn't it? Because actually there is some of the, you know, it's about relating to, it's about those different kind of models that then bring something to the client rather than it's this.
Yeah.
Something in mind about the struggle around the idea of gods, because I meet with a lot of Hindu people, and the god should be a pathway. It's like the doorway into a much wider consciousness. But we want to make everything concrete and the answer. So it's the same with these models. They should be something that you find your own way through and your own voice. But we want to hold one as the truth. So I think that somehow there's something about that for me. There is perhaps there was a change of consciousness, but there was also a sort of trying to immerse yourself in the idol instead of seeing it as a pathway through to something else that needed to be changed. But it has to keep being changed.
Yes.
It's not been changed once. It's like we'll do it again and again. Because we can't bear that, whatever the other side is.
Yeah. I mean, I think it just a final thought, maybe, you know, they're symbols, aren't they? So symbols transmit rather than signs pointing, that difference. And do you see life, consciously or not, as you, as it were, as an individual flourishing and maximising your potential and so on, but rather in suspended isolation to an alternative model, which would be to see yourself, you know, more on this journey as life, as a constant opening up of perception and awareness and knowledge and sight and so on. Again, I think it's very interesting in Philip Pullman's books that the big question is who controls the knowledge, knowledge and control are very tightly related, rather than, say, knowledge and wonder or delight. Mm-hmm. That's there, but it's not the primary driver, whereas in a more spiritual undertaking, it would be to gaze before the heavens, as it were, like Dante in the Heights of Heaven. And control is not really an issue at all. Mm. Look, thank you very much indeed for listening to me longer than I thought, but I hope that has been provocative nonetheless, and I appreciate you coming along, of course. Thank you.
Thank
Cheers.
You.
Yeah.